From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The on-again, off-again relationship between the wrestling teams in the U.S. and Iran is on again this weekend in New York. Ahead on Only a Game, a report from the Wrestling World Championships. Also, Vandy pulls a stunner, although not on the hardwood or on the gridiron, and nonagenarian nabobs of the net compete for gerontological gold. Also ahead on Only a Game, Draco Malfoy forgoes wizardry and promotes carp fishing.
Carp are just the perfect torpedo. And they have a special essence of beauty to them. Like when you put them back in the water, you think, oh yeah, that really is beautiful. So you got to give it a kiss, really.
Stay tuned.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. The State Department is reporting today that Secretary of State Colin Powell will visit Iraq and Kuwait after his one-day meeting with permanent members of the UN Security Council in Geneva today. The statement does not say exactly when he will visit Iraq. Powell is in Geneva to sit down with the French foreign minister in hopes of reaching an agreement over what to do with Iraq. Powell calls a French plan to switch the power of authority from the U.S. to Iraqi leaders as totally unrealistic, saying the country is still too unstable. Yesterday, the UN Security Council ended international sanctions against Libya. The sanctions were imposed for the country's role in the 1988 Pan Am flight over Lockerbie, Scotland. Linda Fasulo reports from the United Nations in New York.
By a vote of 13-0 with the United States and France abstaining, the Security Council lifted 11-year-old air and arms sanctions against Libya, which have been suspended since 1999. The UN decision opens the way for a substantial compensation payment by Libya to families of Lockerbie victims. Libya hailed the vote as a victory in its effort to normalize relations with the West. However, U.S. Deputy Ambassador James Cunningham said the U.S. decision not to block the sanctions lifting does not mean that Libya has rehabilitated itself. He noted that Washington is concerned about Tripoli's poor human rights record, history of involvement in terrorism, and pursuit of weapons of mass destruction. The U.N. lifting does not affect separate U.S. sanctions, which remain in place. For NPR News, I'm Linda Fasulo at the United Nations.
Both Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill warned GOP leaders and the White House against placing new restrictions on veterans' eligibility for disability benefits. Such restrictions are on the table as Congress tries to reach a deal on next year's defense bill. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
There's one thing both the protesting lawmakers and White House officials say they agree on, and that is that veterans who receive military pensions should not have those pensions reduced by the amount of any disability payments they also receive. No such deduction occurs for others who get federal pensions. But allowing full payment of both benefits for veterans could cost $58 billion over the next decade. Faced with massive deficits, the White House and House GOP leaders are discussing redefining who's eligible for a disability benefit. Senate Democratic leaders say that's outrageous and warn that up to two-thirds of 2.2 million veterans receiving disability benefits could lose them. New Jersey Republican Chris Smith, who heads the House Veterans Affairs Committee, says changing the definition of service-connected disabilities could have, quote, far-reaching and unintended consequences. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
Hurricane Isabel is not as strong as it once was, but is still a powerful storm. It now has sustained winds of 150 miles per hour, making it Category 4. Forecasters expect it to stay that way for at least the next 24 hours. You're listening to NPR News. Typhoon Mayimi ripped through the South Korean coast overnight, killing at least 42 people. 25 others are still reported missing. The typhoon caused massive damage, flipping over a floating hotel and knocking down several power lines. It hit the southeastern coast with 135 mile per hour winds before losing strength and being downgraded to a tropical storm today. Some 25,000 people fled to emergency shelters. More than 17 inches of rain fell on parts of the southeastern section of the country. A key measure of how Americans feel about the economy is down this month from August levels. Steve Beckner of Market News International reports.
The University of Michigan's index of consumer sentiment fell more than a point to a preliminary September reading of 88.2, instead of rising as expected. Among households surveyed, assessments of current economic conditions and expectations for how the economy will unfold in coming months deteriorated. Although economic growth has picked up in recent months, it is yet to translate into more jobs, and a perception of poor job prospects often hurts consumer confidence. Despite the weakening of confidence, consumer spending continues to grow. Retail sales rose 0.6% last month. That was not as much as expected, but Bank One chief economist Diane Swonk says the figures understate strong August motor vehicle sales. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner.
The U.S. military has acknowledged it fired on Iraqi police in the town of Fallujah on Friday, killing at least one person. The military has expressed deep regret for the incident. Iraqi police say 8 officers and a Jordanian security guard were killed. For some reason, the U.S. soldiers mistook the officers for hostile forces. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Everybody talks about the twisted priorities, corruption, and hypocrisy that have characterized major college sports for years. Could it be that one of the major colleges is actually addressing the issue? On Tuesday, Gordon Gee, the chancellor of Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, announced that Vanderbilt is eliminating its athletic department. The decision does not mean the university is eliminating athletics. Vanderbilt will continue to field teams in virtually all the intercollegiate sports. Joining me now from his office at Vanderbilt is Chancellor Gee. Mr. Gee, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thank you very much, Bill. Honored to be with you.
What do you hope to accomplish with this restructuring exactly?
Well, I believe that the challenge that we face in intercollegiate athletics is the fact that we've created a silo mentality. We've separated athletics from the rest of the institution, and athletics increasingly has become a game that we play for 3.5 hours on a Saturday afternoon to entertain 100,000 people and then have no connection with the institution. The nature of universities, and I admit it, I am a cockeyed idealist, but I've been doing this for a long time, and my belief is that we have athletics in order to create a vision for heart and mind and spirit and body that is and should be part of what university life is about and not segregated.
Vanderbilt student athletes lead the Southeastern Conference in graduation rates. The program has been one of the cleanest in the country, only one violation as far as the NCAA is concerned over the past 50 years. It sounds to me as if very little needs fixing.
And it's not about fixing, it's about leadership. I've restructured this university based upon a horizontal model which says that each part of the institution supports the other, that we integrate our budgets, we integrate our activities, we connect the dots rather than be 10 colleges and an athletic department connected only by a heating plant or by a telephone wire. And this is the final part of that piece. So it is part of the larger philosophy of where we're going. But also, I served on the President's Commission. I have worked very diligently within the fields of the NCAA to try to develop a strategy whereby we can be successful. And I believe that someone, and why not at Vanderbilt, ought to take that leap off the cliff that says there is another way, there is a new way, there is a way that we can organize ourselves that allows us to be successful on and off the field and allows the student to be a student and an athlete and not simply a fodder for institutional achievement for a couple of hours on a Saturday afternoon.
So I gather your hope would be that universities where the football teams have been a great deal more successful and more widely publicized, places like Florida and Michigan and other places like that, might follow your lead.
Well, I've been president of a number of places that have had those kind of programs, Ohio State, Colorado, West Virginia, and my hope is that I'll get other people to join with me. I'm not naive about that, but my hope is that we'll get others to join. Miles Brand, the president of the NCAA, just put out a statement yesterday that said that this was really the way that universities ought to structure their athletic departments, and I received a number of responses from my colleagues around the country. Basically, they say, well, you go, Gordon, and you jump off the cliff, and if you're successful, we'll follow. You know, it's a scary moment. I was telling someone yesterday that if I were at Ohio State trying this, I would end up pumping gas in Vernal, Utah, my hometown probably. But I am at a place that has run one of the very best athletic departments in the country in terms of success off the field. We intend also with this move to say that we can be successful off the field and on the field by bringing all the resources and all the enthusiasm and all the available talent of the university to bear on this as an opportunity.
The counterargument to efforts to change the current system has always been nothing's really going to change in college basketball and college football until the money isn't there anymore. But as a gigantically profitable TV show, nothing is going to change.
Yeah, you know, I have other bold proposals to go along with this, which I think really address that. One is the fact that I think that we'll never ultimately be successful with intercollegiate athletics unless we tie graduation rates and scholarships together. Number two is I think that we need to make certain that every student is given an opportunity to have a legitimate program, a legitimate course, and that we don't shuttle them off to coaching 101. And the third part of this, which addresses what you've said, is that I believe that we ought to tie graduation rates and television distribution dollars and conference distribution dollars together. Now, we can do what we can do unilaterally, and this is good for Vanderbilt. I honestly believe that, but I hope that by coupling this with some of these other proposals, that we can set someone's house on fire here.
Are you worried at all about alumni reaction? Are you going to get phone calls and letters from Vanderbilt alums who say, doggone it, we've lost 18 straight football games already, and now it's going to get worse?
I have, and you know something? I'm not worried. I tell you why. First of all, Vanderbilt alumni are, as you can well imagine, among the smarter people in this country, and they by and large understand what we're about as an institution. Number two is the fact that the old model hasn't worked. Why not try something? One of the things you need to understand about me, Bill, is the fact that there is no one who enjoys intercollegiate athletics more than I do. I went to for 18 years in a row, I spent January 1st with 50,000 of my closest friends at bowl games, and I miss that. I miss that, but I don't miss it to the point that I'm going to do it at all costs. What I believe is the fact that I believe that we can do this right, and we can also win. And why not try a new model? Because the old one hasn't worked for us.
Gordon Gee is the Chancellor of Vanderbilt University. Chancellor Gee, thank you very much for joining me. I've enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you very much.
The United States and Iran have not enjoyed diplomatic relations since 1979, but the two countries have enjoyed a wrestling friendship for the better part of 15 years, though the visa problems, which kept the Iraqi wrestling team out of the U.S., also threatened to keep the Iranian team at home. The Iranians are now in New York for an Olympic qualifier. Jesse Graham reports from the World Championships at Madison Square Garden.
One by one, members of the Iranian national wrestling team rise to receive a kiss and a tiny white envelope full of cash. Tears well in the eyes of 1968 Olympic gold medalist Abdullah Movahed as he tries to pass the luck of his long winning streak along to the seven weary men who almost didn't make it here. During Wednesday's practice session, the team charges the mats with a prayer and a burst of song. They literally run circles around their competitors, leaping and bounding through a vigorous workout while the other teams take it slow. It's the first time the team has competed in the U.S. in over 2 years. And if team captain Mohammed Talay has his way, it could be the last.
He says nothing against people, nothing against the wrestlers. He thinks with this sort of a trip, they may not come anymore. They may be because it's not only the body, but it is taxing and the mind a lot, and not knowing for several weeks they're going to get a visa or not.
The Iranian team's gripe is a new visa process, which kept them in limbo up until their Tuesday flight to the U.S. Talay says extensive background checks held the team up, forcing athletes to make 2 trips to Turkey for interviews in the last several weeks.
We saw guards up again, just like a few years back.
Iranian-American Mahmoud Azari volunteers as a doctor for the U.S. team. He's worried that the wrestling relationship between the U.S. and Iran may be another casualty of September 11th.
Looks like whatever we had accomplished for 6 or 7 years, it went down the drain, almost all the way down the drain. And that I'm still suffering from.
When the Iranian team came to the U.S. for the 1995 World Cup, it was the first time the two teams had competed since Ayatollah Khomeini took power in 1979. In 1998, U.S. wrestlers were the first American athletes to compete in Iran in over 20 years. In a country where death to America is a popular slogan, U.S. wrestlers were overwhelmed with the adoring reception they received. Kevin Jackson won the gold at the 1998 Takhti Cup in Tehran.
We kind of looked at it like the Chicago Bulls, you know, in their heydays, because when we got to the airport, it was 2 a.m. in the morning. There was over 2,000 fans there in the airport to see, and I think it was more than that in the camera crews. Winning over there was a great experience, and they knew us before we've gone there. Actually, when you walk the streets of Iran and you are in that country, you're more recognized there than you are in your own country, and that was a big change for a lot of us. But it's just because they look at wrestling like we would look at football, basketball, or baseball, or any of the other major sports that we have, that they know us better than the people in the United States know us.
Since 1998, the two countries have competed on a regular basis. But in 1997, the State Department put Iran at the top of a list of countries whose regimes support terrorism and called for all Iranians applying for visas to be fingerprinted. Iranian officials bristled at the procedure, but a brief rift was smoothed over when the regulation was waived for athletes. After the September 11th terrorist attacks, everything changed. First, the World Championships in New York were canceled. Then, last year, the U.S. scrapped its plan to travel to Iran for the World Championships after the State Department reported terrorist threats against the team. So assistant U.S. World Team coach Tom Brands appreciates the Iranian team's presence here, despite diplomatic hurdles.
I think they went out of their way to come here, and based on the circumstances and what happened last year with us not going over there, I think it's a great gesture on their part.
I consider both countries as my country, and if you have two brothers, you want to get them close as much as possible with the way you can.
For Iranian-American Amir Bashira, there's much more at stake here than sport. Bashira, a volunteer for USA Wrestling, spent the last several weeks on nightly calls to Turkey to ensure the team would arrive here. He even made a trip to Ankara.
These are my countries. Both are my countries, and I want to make it closest as possible I can. I'm American-Iranian, so I want to see those countries one day to have a relationship.
The Freestyle Wrestling World Championships run through tomorrow at Madison Square Garden. For Only a Game, I'm Jesse Graham.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Today and tomorrow in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, participants in the 33rd annual Volleyball Super Bowl will be hoping for mild, sunny weather. About 1,700 participants and spectators will gather for what Nude and Nature magazine redundantly calls the most unique event in nudism, this volleyball tournament in the Buff. The event, which organizers defend as seriously competitive, is divided into six skill levels, and according to spokesperson Scott Coatsworth, people do dive for the ball, even on the asphalt courts. He adds, the ones who know how to do it don't even get skinned. One hesitates to think about what happens to the ones who don't know how to do it.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's American League action, the Red Sox ran, but the White Sox got bleached. The score was 7-4 in favor of Boston. Cleveland edged Minnesota 4-3. Detroit blanked Kansas City 3-0. The Yankees bedeviled the Devil Rays by a score of 10-4, and the Blue Jays put the beak to Baltimore and beat the Orioles 4-2. Elsewhere, Oakland topped Texas 9-3, and the Mariners swamped the Angels 7-4. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Charles opines. But first, this weekend in Boston's acoustically perfect Symphony Hall, the 2003 U.S. Open squash tournament will be played. Squash was long known as a game played by sturdy lads at pedigreed prep schools, college men, as long as they attended the right sort of college, stock manipulators who belonged to private and exclusive New York or Philadelphia clubs, and various gentlemen of considerable leisure from such places as Pakistan. Squash, A History of the Game, a new book by James Zug, includes tales of those worthies, but it also recounts stories of the game's mutts and rebels. James Zug joins me now from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Mr. Zug, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
I want to get right to some of the characters whose stories you tell. My favorite is Victor Niederhofer, who, as you put it on page 131, quote, cocked a snook at squash's blue bloods. What exactly did you have in mind when you wrote that?
That's a cricket term, which I'm a big fan of. And he was a notorious character both on and off the court and became famous in the late 60s for boycotting the Nationals for 5 years because he felt there was a good deal of anti-Semitism in the game.
Well, you do characterize him, as I say, as a something of an eccentric, but he deserves credit, I think, for his stand. For years, as you say, he did refuse to play tournaments in clubs where he could not become a member. Did the tactic of depriving tournaments of one of the country's best players succeed in opening up the game of squash?
In the short term, it really didn't, and a lot of people, I think, ignored the boycott, but it was such a symbolic move. He easily would have won those tournaments, and in the long run, he was a force for opening up the game and bringing it to the public in the 70s after he ended his boycott.
Before and after the boycott, he distinguished himself by doing things like wearing different colored sneakers. I mean, different the left from the right. Sometimes at formal occasions when he was dressed in a tux. How else did he kind of shock the squash world?
He was known for walking around in the locker room before matches wearing a sock on his right hand, which he said was a way to prevent people from shaking hands with him and distracting him from preparing for the games. He claimed he only read the National Enquirer newspaper and was a sort of leading trader on Wall Street, but didn't read anything but the Enquirer. He also, a notorious training regimen included running through New York City at night. He'd run from his offices down in Wall Street home carrying a squash racket, and he would do this sort of at 2 or 3 in the morning. And he did this for years, and so people had glimpses of him, you know, on Madison Avenue carrying a racket.
A more recent champion is Mark Talbot. I know the first generation of professional squash players didn't make a whole lot of money at their tournaments, but did Mark Talbot really have to live in his truck?
A lot of players actually did that. He wasn't the only one. And he slowly was able to carve out a living, but in those first years, he probably did need to do that. Only the top four or five players were making a good living, and he wasn't in the top four or five at the time. I think he also liked that kind of lifestyle. He was a great fan of the Grateful Dead, and so he could, you know, jet off to a concert in between tournaments. So it gave him some flexibility.
A fair chunk of your book builds up to and then tells the story of one exceptional match between Mark Talbot and Jahangir Khan of Pakistan. Can one match really be as important to the squash world as you say this one was?
It was such a symbolic match. It was between what most people consider the greatest player ever from overseas, Jahangir, who hadn't lost a match in years. And he just was brutalizing the North American players. One match he beat one of the top players 15-love in the final game, which is just unheard of. And so it was a remarkable achievement for Mark to be able to beat him. And he also beat him in such a dramatic way where the game went into the fifth and final game, and then it went into a tiebreaker in the fifth game. And Mark was able to win by 2 points.
Now, you say that this is one of those athletic events where millions of people claim to have been there, although the venue probably seated about 2,500.
Oh, it's even less, just over 1,000. Uh-huh. And they think about 900 people were there, but it's sort of like Bobby Thompson at the Polo Grounds that, you know, many more people claim that they saw this epic match.
You are a squash player yourself, and you have been a very successful player. In fact, at several points in this book, you are compelled to write about your own achievements in the third person. That must have been a little bit uncomfortable.
No. This is the problem of being named after one's father.
Ah.
My father was a well-known and pretty good player, and he won the national doubles a couple times. And even now, I get calls saying, you know, oh, your father wrote such a great book, and my dad, you know, often will play along with it and claim that he wrote it, and he always takes my paychecks, which is a problem.
I can see how it might be. Much of the first part of your book is about the private schools and universities, which had, I gather, a near monopoly on squash for a very long time. At one point, you even refer to squash as having the image of, quote, a game played less by inclination than by right of birth. But the end of the history mentions several programs such as Squash Busters here in Boston that recruit minority kids from public schools to the game. Is it fair to say that that's the future of squash?
It'll always be a part of the game, the private prep school, country club. That'll always be there. But the future is of opening up the game, and it's changed so dramatically in the last 30 years. And these youth enrichment programs in different cities around the country are just sort of the leading edge of that. They're getting hundreds of kids who come from backgrounds that don't normally lead to the game of squash, getting excited about the game and playing in high school and even now playing in college.
James Ugg is the author of Squash, A History of the Game, published by Scribner. Jim, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're welcome.
I've had 6 hip operations, 2 discs out in my back. I have an ankle that's been fused because I used to be a pole vaulter and I came down on my heel. So they took bone from my hip and locked my ankle. So I thought you might like to hear that.
Under normal circumstances, I probably wouldn't particularly like to have heard that. But since the former patient, New Hampshire resident Bob Biddle, was coming off the tennis court when he laid that list of surgeries on me, I was intrigued. Mr. Biddle had just won a match in the 90 and over division of the U.S. National Men's Grass Court Championships held earlier this month at the Longwood Cricket Club in Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts. Bob Biddle's appearance at the event surprised even himself.
Actually, I was going to hang up my racket. I even tore up my entry blank, and they called me up and said they want as many 90s as possible this year. So I said, okay, I'll come.
For the sake of the strength of the field, it was a good thing Bob Biddle made that decision, as Mr. Biddle and his wife learned by reading some of the notes on the bulletin board on the porch beside the courts. Some of the other potential players hadn't been so fortunate.
He took a fall on the courts 2 weeks ago, and he's still trying to recoup. He hopes to be there next year when he will be 100 years old.
Among the younger men showing up for the tournament and prevailing, as it turned out, was Ali Ritzenberg. He turned 85 just this week, and whether he owes more to tennis than tennis owes to him is a tough call.
I've been given credit for having started the tennis renaissance back at the Kennedy years when the entire Kennedy group came and played at a club that I started, and I taught down at the White House, and that supposedly ignited the whole tennis field.
Ali Ritzenberg, who began playing tennis when he was 9, became a professional shortly after graduating from college. 76 years of experience has taught him perspective on the days when his game's not on.
Oh, it's not the end of the world. I've won a number of these before, and I've won the world championship, and so it's always fun to get another golden ball, and I think there's too much emphasis on the sports anyway, and the world is honoring the jocks a little bit too much.
If so, Ritzenberg himself ran the risk of being excessively honored last week. He won both the singles and doubles titles in the 85 and over division, adding to his considerable store 2 more of the little gold balls traditionally awarded to national champions. For the record, he is not yet threatening the trophy trove of his counterpart in the 90 and over division, Gardner Malloy.
I've won 127 gold balls.
Do you sort of hand them out, or have you got them all stored somewhere?
Well, I've given some away, and I have some at home and so forth. And they give a silver ball for runner-up, so I got a big plate of silver balls and, of course, 127 gold balls.
Actually, 128 as of the end of last week's tournament, and another silver ball to roll around on his plate as well. Gardner Malloy was runner-up in the 90 and over singles and a winner in the doubles division. In both, he says, the competitors come in two categories.
50% show up to win, 50% just show up to say that they play in the national championships, and those that do that are those that can't play. I mean, you know, they're just hackers, and it's a joke with them and an honor because they can tell our grandchildren and so forth, well, I played in the national championships back in so-and-so.
But what they're really likely to tell their grandchildren and great-grandchildren is, I took a game off Gardner Malloy.
Yes, I've heard that before, you know. And I played him, and we played out there, but, you know, the grass was wet, and I couldn't quite get to the ball, and he lobbed me too much, and he threw in that drop shot, but I got two games, one game in each set, and it was closer than the score indicates.
This time around, one of those claiming that the grass was too wet and that Gardner Malloy lobbed him too much may be Doug Crary, a runner-up to Malloy in the doubles tournament. A national champion in the 75-year-old division 15 years ago, Crary, who sports a neatly trimmed white fringe of a beard, is notorious for various reasons. He claims to have driven nearly 700,000 miles in his Volkswagen Beetle to get to tournaments all over the country and to have spent at least 500 nights in the car. Like the fellows he's been competing against for the past half century and more, Doug Crary has stories. Some of the best of them extend beyond the world of tennis. Crary himself was apparently quite a baseball player.
I played shortstop against Joe DiMaggio quite a number of times, and he and I tried out for the San Francisco Seals.
Mm-hmm.
There were no Giants. The Giants were New York.
Right.
Okay, DiMaggio and I tried out together. I thought he was a rather clumsy shortstop, but he hit the ball.
Mr. Crary is, to state the obvious, a conversationalist, besides being the winner of several of the coveted gold and silver balls himself. He enjoyed a long career teaching music in various public schools, which left his summers free for tennis. When he stopped to breathe for a moment during our conversation in the Longwood clubhouse, where some players were waiting to get back on the court and others were dozing in easy chairs, I asked Mr. Crary if his work with various bands and orchestras explained why he held in his hand a whistle-type instrument called a tonette.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm afraid you're going to play it for me.
Yeah. That's interesting. Sing. That's just Elmer's tune.
Nicely done. I'm astonished nobody's dancing.
I played it at the dinner here last night. That fact, they even asked me to.
And by asking him to, assured no doubt that Doug Crary will be back again next year, playing tennis, playing the tonette, and, bless him, playing his 90s like some manic leprechaun for all that they are worth. My only regret in stumbling upon this tournament was that I had so little company. Crary, Malloy, Ritzenberg, and the rest played in front of each other and a few spouses, that was all. Everybody else missed a remarkable time. You're listening to Only a Game. As the host of the 2004 Summer Olympics, Greece automatically gained the opportunity to field a baseball team in the competition. Unlike basketball and soccer, baseball is not a popular sport in Greece, but officials in the host country were nevertheless determined to hold tryouts. All might have been lost if Baltimore Orioles owner Peter Angelos, whose parents were born on the Greek island of Karpathos, hadn't offered the services of an Orioles scout.
Prospective players, please sign up at the table, pin your number to your shirt, and proceed to the batting cage.
Okay, son. Your name?
I'm Noma. You know, Noma Agathiopoulos.
Let me see that application. You're not going to fool anybody with this kid. You've run your signature off the page. Next!
Name?
Eric Karros, Jr.
Papuise, Eric.
I
said, where are you from, Eric?
Athens, Georgia.
Did you say Georgia?
Yeah, but Athens, Athens.
Next!
Foolish warriors, do not stray from the games of winged feet, for it is three strikes and you are out.
What the heck was that?
How should I know? They were here when I got here this morning.
Oh, callow youth, follow not the path of the baseline. It winds into confusion, and it cannot lead you home. Home.
You're not helping here, ladies.
Wait a minute. These guys from Delphi, Thaki, and Syracuse, they're all from New York, aren't they?
Right, and I'm not getting a good feeling about this guy from Minneapolis either.
If only it were a competition to determine which country had the greatest ancient philosophers.
Or perhaps the strongest claim regarding the development of medical ethics.
If Plato to Aristotle was a double play combination and Hippocrates was at first...
Yes, a shame. Then the other teams would have to beware of Greeks snaring hits.
Next.
Hey, fellas, how you doing?
Where are you from, son?
Ask not the questions unless you would know the answers. Oh, foolish men.
Who are those Cretans?
Hey!
Pay them no mind. Where are you from?
New York.
Well, at least he's honest. Next!
No, but I was in the Greek pizza shops all the time. You know, I know all the names of the food. You got your gyroscopes, your bakla, balaclavas there on the counter, your pizza.
Strike three.
On this one, I have to agree with him. See, son, by that logic, if you'd eaten lunch at McDonald's, you could play for Scotland.
Did that Garciopoulos, who's this kid, stick around?
Next summer, Greece will field a baseball team, about two-thirds of which will be composed of college or minor league players who have at least one grandparent who is at least vaguely Greek. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company, with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment. On the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan & Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Senior citizens dance in Miami's Little Havana. Horns blare in the bombed-out streets of Kosovo. And steel drums ring below Broadway and a New York subway platform. I'm Scott Simon. These sounds of our world on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Bob C. with these sports headlines. In yesterday's National League action, the Cubs edged the Reds 7-6. Montreal manhandled the Mets 7-4. Pittsburgh flummoxed Philadelphia 8-4. Florida hornswoggled Atlanta 8-4. And Houston stymied St. Louis 14-5. Elsewhere, Colorado rocked Arizona, whose offense deserted them. The score was 8-2 in that contest. Los Angeles beat San Diego 6-0, and San Francisco dismantled Milwaukee 8-2. For Only a Game, I'm Bob C. in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. British fishermen teach their U.S. counterparts not to carp about carp. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me to comment on the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
That was awful, Bill.
Only the same as it ever was. Major League Baseball's race toward the postseason remains nearly as muddled as it was last week at this time. Do we have a dream postseason matchup to suggest?
First of all, everybody who admits that they didn't like the wild card 5 years ago, please put their hand up. Thank you, Mr. Costas. You can sit down. Do we have a dream matchup? I have a dream couple of matchups. Mm-hmm. I would like to see the Red Sox and Yankees in the American League Championship Series and the Cubs and the Cardinals in the National League Championship Series. I would like to see the Red Sox and Cardinals in a rematch of 46 and 67 in the mm-hmm. World Series, because you know if the Cubs and the Red Sox make the World Series, NASA can only cover a small percentage of the sky vis-a-vis asteroids, and I frankly don't trust the astronomical circumstances behind that one.
Well, Jason Stark, writing for ESPN.com, has picked the Red Sox to win it all, so that should about finish Boston.
Well,
right?
No, actually they are, if you take all the philosophical and, you know, voodoo encrustation and remove it, the Red Sox have a team that's built very well for the postseason. They have enough starting pitching to get through. Pedro Martinez is back pitching the way he should. And they do hit the ball, and they have a remarkable chin. I mean, they are a team that is not out of a game. They're built to score runs in bunches, and they're entertaining, and they don't seem to be trapped by their past.
Now they really are finished.
It's over now.
The personal trainer who works with Barry Bonds also works with sprinter Kelly White. Ms. White has lost the two gold medals she won at the World Championships in Paris last month following a positive drug test. And last week, the office of that trainer, whose name, by the way, is Dr. Brian Goldman, was searched by IRS and drug agents. Should we be worrying on Barry's behalf?
I think we shouldn't be wasting our time spending federal tax dollars in the war, while we're in the middle of a war on terror investigating nutritional supplements, but that's just me. Anytime you hear the initials I, R, and S involved in any investigation, people even tangentially involved should be worried. The interesting part of the story to me is that Dr. Goldman prescribed the substance to Ms. White to treat, as he says, symptoms of narcolepsy, which is really a remarkable condition to have if you're a sprinter.
Well, maybe it's a sprinter if the race is fast enough.
I mean, a 5,000-meter runner or a marathoner, yeah, I can see that.
Meanwhile, ex-Major League Baseball Commissioner Peter Uberoth has withdrawn from the California governor's race. I guess maybe the sports world needs a more serious contender, maybe David Stern or Paul Tagliabue.
I think it's more a measure of how Peter Uberoth has fallen in the public eye. You know, he was the triumphant commissioner of baseball, and now he's already lost the California gubernatorial race to Gerry Coleman.
In chapter whatever it is, in the story of ex-Ohio State running back Maurice Claret, Mr. Claret has now been suspended for the entire season. Wouldn't it surprise people if he were to announce that he's enjoying his French and chemistry classes so much that he's decided to stay in school in Columbus anyway?
It would knock me out of my chair, actually. I think, number one, I don't think Ohio State wants him hanging around the campus, drawing attention and camera crews to himself. There's talk about him going home to Youngstown to play for the Fighting Penguins of 1AA Youngstown State. There's also talk about him possibly going to Grambling. Once again, I mean, it's a further illustration that this is a case for which the informal rules that bind college and professional football together have very large holes in them, and he's fallen through one of them.
The WNBA Finals began last night. Michael Cooper's L.A. Sparks took Game 1 from Bill Laimbeer's Detroit Shock. Wouldn't it be great if the league could relax the rules just for this series and allow these former nemeses to suit up for their respective teams?
Well, I think that's a terrible thing for you to say, Bill. The Detroit Shock also has Karl Malone's daughter, Cheryl Ford, playing, so mm-hmm. there's a lot of bloodline, a lot of NBA connection here. The Sparks would seem to be favored, but the Detroit Shock are interestingly in that they will run with the Sparks, which no team has done so far, so.
The Washington Wizards have signed Gilbert Arenas as a free agent, and Mr. Arenas has guaranteed that the Wizards will make the playoffs next season, so we can take that to the bank?
Don't do that, Gilbert. You know, don't guarantee stuff. You know why? Because people remember. It's not 1941. People aren't going to forget this. This is going to be, I mean, first of all, you're going to hear about it in every arena. But, you know, Gilbert Arenas is a heck of a player. The Wizards haven't made the playoffs in 6 years, and they haven't won a playoff game since 1988, and even Michael Jordan couldn't get him in there. You know, it's a good thing for Gilbert to do to attach himself to the fans, but it's also a promise that can come back and hit you over the head with a big old tack hammer come February.
Elsewhere on the NBA front, LeBron James is the key marketing gimmick even for teams that aren't the Cleveland Cavaliers. I wonder if his picture will be on each club's media guide cover.
I love this. The Miami Heat and the Phoenix Suns and the Denver Nuggets are all using him to sell partial season ticket plans. The Miami Heat is even calling a four-game package, including the November 12th game against the Cavs, the LeBron James plan. Besides playing on the national team, running for governor of California is the only thing he's not doing right now.
The New York Rangers once again found the oldest free agent available. Marc Messier will play his 25th season for the Rangers this winter. Good move?
Well, I mean, it's a gold watch for him. He's the one who came there and they won the Stanley Cup. I don't imagine he'll contribute very much. It will be a nice way to say goodbye. He's not all that old. Remarkably enough, Marc Messier is only 42. But I don't think this will affect the Rangers one way or the other.
The determination of the authorities at Elma High School in Elma, Washington, to apply the dress code to everybody equally means that the cheerleaders there will no longer be allowed to wear their short skirts to school. And I gather that some traditionalists are very unhappy.
Kathy Shaw, whose daughter is on the drill team, said, "Elma has dropped back to the dark ages." Oh, an unkind person might suggest that it maybe wasn't that long a trip. It does impress me, though, that Elma, Washington, is sort of behaving like your Aunt Elma would have behaved. It's sort of living up to its name.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Aunt Elma's the one who stands out on the front porch and says, "Come here so I can throw a raincoat over you."
Teachers at the Thalwil Primary School in Zurich have a new strategy for fighting obesity among students. Yes, they do. They're offering skateboarding lessons. Don't they understand that kids with broken arms and legs tend to sit around and get even more obese?
Well, don't they understand that that there are major American universities with football programs that already offer skateboarding 101, 102, and 205, the graduate seminar?
Finally, Charlie, the just-released list of folks receiving farm subsidies from the government may surprise the taxpayers who are footing the bill. Scottie Pippen is on that list, as is Ted Turner.
Well, I always knew Ted Turner had the big ranch property in Montana, but apparently he also has some land in Kansas and Florida and South Dakota. But I have to admit that of all the many public images that Scottie Pippen has had in his public career, Gentleman Farmer was one that would not have occurred to me.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he separates the wheat from the chaff each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Oh, you're just fishing for compliments.
The baseball season spins and skids toward its conclusion, and soon we will celebrate the 100th edition of the World Series. Much is often made of baseball's immutability. Three strikes and you're out, same as it was 100 years ago. In fact, much has changed. Always the intention of the owners was to maximize profits, but it's been a long time since the league has allowed a magnate to oversell his ball yard, pack the excess customers behind ropes in the outfield, and invoke a temporary ground rule that calls everything hit into the throng a double. Now the owners just raise ticket prices. Baseball long ago lost its happy and lucrative distinction as the only game in town. When the World Series was in its adolescence, there was no National Football League, of course, and the top college teams in the land were employed by Yale and Harvard. Not so long ago, former baseball commissioner Bart Giamatti said of the game that it was designed to break its fans' hearts, ending just when we needed it most as the wind picked up and summer surrendered. Now, if he had the leisure, the average fan might be heard to ask of the end of the baseball season, who cares? He's flipping the channels between the innings of the September and October games to keep track of his football bets. He's checking to see which hockey players are holding out during training camp and making sure his basketball season ticket package includes the LeBron games. Come to think of it, that's the big difference, isn't it? Baseball's essentially the game it was, despite the attempts to soup it up with glowing TV graphics, mischievous mascots, and rap music between the innings. The stadium gates still open when they've always opened in the spring and close pretty much when they've always closed. It's just harder to hear the melody of the summer game in September under the clamor and drums of all the noisy neighbors. Here in the United States, carp are largely considered to be ugly, slimy, and unworthy of an angler's efforts. In England, they are revered as a game fish. Recently, in a quiet corner of upstate New York, carp enthusiasts from both sides of the Atlantic staged a tournament and introduced stateside Philistines to the joys of fishing for these bottom-feeding brutes. North Country Public Radio's David Summerstein reports from the banks of the St. Lawrence River.
On a hot and steamy day, teen anglers and their parents are fanned out along the St. Lawrence River near a roadside picnic area. Matt Dawson of Hamilton, Ontario, sits under a shade umbrella and keeps an eye on a 12-foot fishing rod. He and his mother came here for different reasons.
I don't know. For fun, I guess.
For the money.
Oh, you are.
A $10,000 grand prize is at stake for this, the inaugural St. Lawrence International Junior Carp Tournament. 111 to 18-year-olds are here from England, Italy, Canada, and nine U.S. states to practice the art of carp fishing. Instructors traveled from England, where carp angling is nearly as popular as soccer. The BBC's fishing guru, Martin James, warns kids about what they're up against.
Now, the carp is probably the most brainiest of fish. The IQ of a brown trout is 6. The IQ of a carp is 12, so that makes it twice as intelligent as that spotted little trout that you tried to catch. So the carp have to be stalked. They're very cunning. You mustn't spook them. Spook them and they've gone. So you've got to present the bait to them or the fly to them without them realising there's any danger.
The idea of presenting the bait exemplifies the Brits' craft, gallantry, and respect for carp. The tournament's headliner is actor and carp angler Tom Felton. He played evildoer Draco Malfoy in the Harry Potter movies. Speaking to fawning fans at a pre-tournament press conference, Felton said a prize carp deserves a good smooch.
I think you end up agreeing with me, because a lot of fish are not slimy, but they let out a lot of slime and ooze, and they're very thin and horrible mouths and beady little eyes. Carp are just the perfect torpedo. And they have a special essence of beauty to them. That when you put them back in the water, you think, oh, yeah, that really is beautiful. So you've got to give it a kiss, really.
Once it's there, you're going to have your hands here. This is going to go directly over. You pull with this hand and push with this hand.
Back on the riverbank, an instructor teaches Kat McGuire of Rhode Island how to cast. As she whips the rod forward, she admits it wasn't the angling alone that lured her here.
I wanted to try the carp fishing and, you know, Tom Felton, too.
Did you get to meet Tom Felton?
Yeah, he was extremely nice. But, you know, the carp thing is really fun, too.
And you started that. Did you put it through the eye first, or did you?
Yeah, what you do, you just
put it through the eye, then wind it around, then come back?
Yeah, you put it through the eye, wind it around, and then just come back through the back of the eye.
Very good.
Yeah.
In the shade of a willow, 15-year-old Warren Dolan of Essex, England, teaches 34-year-old tournament marshal Dan Scamperly how to tie a hair rig. Scamperly's fished on the St. Lawrence all his life, but like most locals, he's never fished for carp.
It seems completely different. They don't bait the hook. They have what's called a hair rig, which hangs off the bottom of the hook. And I guess these carp, the bottom feeders, and they sort of suck on the bait.
Most anglers use cooked fermented corn as bait. But Kevin Cox, a tourist from a London suburb who's fishing with a guide nearby, says the filet mignon of carp bait are little hard-shelled dough balls called boilies. He reaches into a plastic bag full of them.
You want to have a look at those?
Smell like gumballs. Now, am I seeing here, am I reading this correctly, that there's different flavors? Like there's pineapple and banana, cranberry, nudafruit.
Oh, you name it. It's all there. It's good stuff.
Chocolate orange. What would make you change to tutti frutti nudafruit,
Well, if
for
I'm
example?
Not catching on a particular flavor, I will change. You know, and if I start catching on that flavour, then I'll stick with it. If I stop catching on that, then I'll change again.
I'm trying, Brad.
Matt Dawson from Ontario's got a bite. An instructor coaches him as he tries to land a 10-pound carp.
Pick from the up, and then when it's up in the air, wind down.
Oh, wind down. What?
It's a big fight for a relatively small fish. The biggest carp in the St. Lawrence weigh 50 or 60 pounds. After being caught, each fish is carefully netted, then weighed in a padded sack so as not to damage its scales. Anglers will even dab antiseptic on a fish's wound before releasing it. Essex England's Warren Dolan says that's only right.
We don't kill the fish. We don't eat them. If they're like a known fish that keep them getting caught, we name them. We name the fish. Like if it goes to a dark orange to a light orange, call it two-tone. That's why.
You guys have pretty great respect for these fish.
Yeah, yeah. What, they don't do no harm to us, so why do we do any harm to them?
Dolan's carp philosophy paid off. He took home the $10,000 grand prize, his four biggest carp weighing a total of 75 pounds. Tournament organizers hope carp fever will catch on in this country and elevate carp from the bottom of America's fish hierarchy to the status they enjoy across the ocean. For Only a Game, I'm David Summerstein on the banks of the St. Lawrence in Waddington, New York.
14 pounds, 14 and a quarter, so.
14 and a quarter. Okay, you want to let it go?
Off he goes. Yes, sir.
Want to go home, but I ain't got some fishing clothes. Dog on my bad luck soul. I want to go home, but I ain't got some fishing clothes. Ain't got the fishing talking about clothes. I want to go home, dog on my bad luck soul.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. We had help this week from Joel Hurt at North Country Public Radio and from Manoli Wetherill at NPR's New York Bureau. Special thanks to the Only a Game Hellenic players, Christine Fischera, Tony Randolph, Sean Cole, George Hicks, Matt Odette, Peter Lydotes, and Steph Katsonis. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or view photos of lovely torpedo-like St. Lawrence River carp or the senior servers at Longwood. Please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from longtime tennis champion Gardner Malloy.
I'm in the International Tennis Hall of Fame and eight others. I think maybe that's the record.
Remarkable. The voting must have required several generations of sports writers. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Wake up in the morning, catch the first thing I see. Dog on my bad luck soul. This old world down here is a big bad luck to me. Big bad luck to talk about me. This was a big bad luck to me.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.